effort to destroy as many federal institutions as he can while he can. That said, at the risk of contradicting myself, we can directly blame him as leader of the current government for a loss of $1.15 million in the federal government funding over 3 years starting in 2012. You see, since 1997, CBC grants have remained stable at the number of $1.2 billion, plus or minus $100 million every so often, until 2008. From that date onward, the Harper government has consistently reduced the CBC's grant, to the point of breaking their own election promise to do so. You see, Harper and his supporters will say something like, well, if it cannot compete in a free market, we should not artificially keep it on public-funded life support. Funny how you can spend billions on the tar sands as a publicly-funded life support, yet feck you, public broadcaster. And therein lies the important difference. Public broadcaster. In a Senate committee meeting recently, a Harper puppet stated that the money spent on the public broadcaster may be better spent by giving the money to private production companies. Here is yet another example of the federal government decrying public support of a needed public institution while thinking nothing of providing corporate welfare. I mean, I feel quite confident if funding was delivered directly to private production companies, those companies would be like Bell, Alliance Atlantis, or Quebecor. None of that would be spent on culturally important productions like 22 Minutes, Marketplace, Fifth Estate, Rick Mercer, or even the Republic of Doyle, or anything that sort of reflects the vanishing Canadian identity. No, instead we'd get reality TV a la US. You know, you gotta love your Kardashians and Jersey Shore. Now, according to the president of the Crown Corporation, Herbert LaCroix, the CBC will not consider broadcasting events that don't allow the network to break even. This is the opposite of the mandate of a Crown Corporation. A Crown Corporation, like the CBC, is to provide necessary services irrespective of their profitability. Profitability is not their mandate. Part of their mandate is to be predominantly and distinctively Canadian, reflect Canada and its regions to national and regional audiences while serving the special needs of those regions. The CBC provides a coast-to-coast identity and supports Canadian artists and intellectuals. It provides a popular forum for well-reasoned arguments, for ideas to flourish, for the kinds of intellect that stands in stark contrast to the popular infotainment produced and consumed daily in mass quantities. It's important to remember the CBC and Radio Canada can't be viewed or judged by the same standards as mainstream media. Their raison d'etre is not simply distraction. It is to be universally accepted, contribute to a sense of national identity and community, and, most importantly, keep a safe distance from vested financial interest. What that means is you can't necessarily assess their worth based on numbers, but rather good programming, value to the nation. You see, and many of our listeners may be aware of this, but south of the Canadian border is the biggest exporter of culture to the world, the USA. Now, maybe you, my dear listeners, may have fantasized about becoming a Yank. And well, if you do, I urge you to move. You see, for those of us who can remember that Canada is not the United States, we are not militaristic, in spite of what Harper government would have you believe vis-a-vis the War of 1812. We won, we're proud of it, we don't really need to rub it in. We're not self-absorbed. We believe in consensus, in politeness, perhaps to a fault. Before Harper became Prime Minister, you could travel the world with a maple leaf on your back as a respected and welcome traveler. So much so, Americans would be posers pretending to be Canadian because Americans were and are, well, generally despised globally. Sadly, this is no longer the case. Now, a lot of that can be placed at the feet of the conservative governments who have radically altered our global image, and not in a good way. But part of the blame is that we, as a nation, have changed, and again, not in a good way. Part of the negativity comes from the cultural imperialism of the United States. How our airwaves are dominated by U.S. content. And no, it's not dominant because it's better. Sure, some good stuff comes out of the U.S., but also from the U.K. and Australia, etc. But we don't get the best of the world. We get cheap American content. And that is damaging our psyche. According to the CRTC guidelines, there are supposed to be 60% Canadian content and 50% Canadian content during prime time. I did a quick check of a couple of our profit-motivated channels. So there's roughly 21 hours of prime time a week, really 15 because you only usually count weekdays. Of that, there were only 2 hours of Canadian content during weekly prime time. That's 13%. So it's not like private corporations can be relied upon to foster Canadian culture or identity. And for reference, the CBC's mission is defined by the Broadcasting Act, which states the CBC, as the nation's public broadcaster, should provide radio and television services incorporating a wide range of programming that informs, enlightens, and entertains. The programming provided by the corporation should be predominantly and distinctively Canadian, contribute to shared national consciousness and identity, and reflect the multicultural and multiracial nature of Canada. It should also reflect its regions to the nation and to regional audiences, while serving the specific needs of those regions and actively contributing to the flow and exchange of cultural expressions. It also must be made available throughout Canada. Under the current funding structure, there is no way for the CBC to achieve its mandate. This will not get better. As part of the cuts, the CBC said that radio coverage of live music performances will be cut, local events will be cancelled or consolidated into regional shows, television will have one less original series, replaced by foreign content, high-cost reality series, shows like Battle of the Blades, replaced by low-costing shows, cancellation of late-night news in the North. Again, I say cancellation of late-night news in the North. Crikey, people. The grand total of the entire $1.5 million the CBC stands to lose is less than the cost of one F-35 fighter. I realize that my hard-earned tax dollars don't always go to what I personally, as a voter, find most important. The War of 1812 commemoration, anyone? But it's imperative that most of the expenses reflect somewhat of the people's values. And there's more. Even if you say that I love my US TV, there's another extremely important role the CBC plays. Although funded by the government, it is not a mouthpiece of the government. Unlike corporate media, it does not have to march to a profit margin or corporate agenda. You see, it was also announced that the news department of the CBC will be cut by $13.3 million, or a loss of 115 jobs. This means our ability to get an independent view of the world, our country, or our government is severely limited. I have pointed out before that I was impressed at the amount of coverage the CBC has given the Unfair Elections Act. Well, with reduced funding, we will not get that viewpoint. Harper's dictatorship will have an easier hand at destroying this nation if the population is no longer informed. And it is not like Canadians don't want to fund the CBC. Polling shows that 80% of Canadians want to keep funding for the CBC. Of those, half of them think it should be increased. And that number is almost four times larger than what it was in 2012. People are noticing what's happening to the CBC, and they're worried and definitely displeased. Even a good majority of conservative voters support funding the CBC. 83% think the CBC plays an important role in strengthening Canada's culture and identity. Support for the CBC has increased, as well as the number of people calling for an increase in funding. Conversely, those who thought that the CBC should be cut have been steadily declining. Canadians overwhelmingly think that only the CBC is the best provider of Canadian content. Heritage Minister James Moore in 2012 said, "We believe in a national public broadcaster. We have said that we will maintain or increase support for the CBC. That is our platform, and we have said it before, and we will continue to be committed to it." Bullshit, complete lie. When asked about that statement in 2011, 24% supported it. When asked last year, that number had almost doubled to 48%, with an overall positive of 74%. 72% of conservatives think the CBC should receive federal money, for fact's sake. Hell, even the right-wing National Post said a thousandth of our GDP, which is what taxpayers' contribution to the CBC amounts to, is not too high a price to spend for a smarter Canada. And there's another aspect here I'm not sure I have the time to spend on, but we have the most concentrated media ownership in the world. That means when you read a paper, watch the news, or listen to radio, well, the provider of all that was one megacorp, one corporate message, one agenda, and I can assure you it was not one in your best interests. This also means that these for-profit, private, self-serving corporations have an ever-increasing influence over our democracy. As it is because of the coverage by the CBC that the Fair Election Act is being presented in a proper context. most of the media reporting, including key interviews with Sheila Fraser, Mark Maird, and Harry Neufeld, were first seen on the CBC. That means Canadians are becoming more and more distrustful that the information they are receiving via the media is unbiased, that it does not have some hidden agenda, not unlike our current government. Okay, wait, I can no longer say that the Harper government has a hidden agenda. There definitely is an agenda, but it's no longer hidden. Like some exhibitionist at a porn star awards, he's waving in everyone's face, daring us to do anything about it, because he believes we can't. And what is horrific is that the board of directors and the president of CBC are political appointees, handpicked by Harper himself via the governor general. Okay, side note. I say via the governor general because this is another example of sort of role reversal where that has allowed the PM to accumulate more and more power. You see, technically these appointments are done by the governor general, but tradition has evolved that the governor general will appoint whoever the PM advises them to appoint. So in law, the governor general has all the power and the PM has none. But in reality, the PM is the true ruler of this nation. So almost 90% of Canadians think that these jobs should be apolitical. But of course, that would mean Harper may have to experience some sort of pushback on his agenda. So the status quo on that one for now. What agenda? Well, he's been doing to the CBC what he is trying to do to Canada Post. Starve it of cash, reduce the quality of service, and marginalize its effectiveness. This will, of course, reduce the amount of support it will get in the public, which will lead to more cuts, more withering, and eventually, when the last spade of dirt finally buries the institution, no one will be around to care. But people are not stupid. Over 70% of people polled believes he wants the CBC dead and favors private broadcasters. And it's not new. Check out a link in our show notes where I wrote a whole article about this 2 years ago. And it's not like there is not another way to solve all the CBC's funding issues. A great example can be found in England in the BBC. The BBC and most of Europe fund their public broadcaster via a television license fee. In the UK, this is a fee of about £145 or a little over $260 a year per household. This would provide the CBC with a budget of over $3 billion a year. Currently, the CBC's budget is about one-third that. Can you imagine the quality of program the CBC could produce with that kind of funding? We currently spend, through taxes, about $34 per person. The French, twice that. And for those thinking ahead, we only spend 13% of what the British spend. Out of 18 Western nations, think Sweden, Spain, Japan, Germany, etc., we came third last from spending on our broadcaster, beating only New Zealand and the U.S. The average of these nations was actually $87, almost three times what we spend. And it's not only the dollar amount, it's its predictability, the reliability, the certainty of that level of funding. Currently, the CBC holds its breath every budget because it is at the mercy of the ruling government. And considering how much this government sees ruling as dictating, well, the CBC has not been able to plan for the future because Harper believes it has no future. Now you might say, Don, you sound a little alarmist, a little over the top. Well, fuck that. Harper has destroyed over 100 years of continuity by eliminating the long-form census. So we no longer can say with any reliability what the state of the nation is. But more to the point, Harper can claim what he will, and we no longer have an objective measure to judge his dictates. He destroyed the original Canadian wheat pool, something that is now being felt as farmers' grain is no longer being shipped to market in favor of oil, a fact that did not happen in the past because the wheat pool would and had taken the rail corporations to court and won. That collective power was decimated by Harper, and now people suffer. Harper has muzzled Canadian scientists, made civil servants swear loyalty oath. He has a willful disdain for experts of any kind because they may express a reality that does not coincide with the conservative agenda, the latest example being his attempts to rig the next election via the Unfair Elections Act. My father commented upon the election of Harper that he would fix the system so as to ensure his rule over the country. At the time, it sounded like tinfoil hat kind of talk, even to me. The time has proven he was right. Well, folks, it's not going to get any better. I'd like to tell you that if we only united and protested, that we could change things, but we can't. If you voted for Harper in the last elections, well, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. And you have reaped a potential end of the democratic nation once called Canada. It's ironic that Harper hops around the world posing as defenders of people's democracy. Think the Ukraine. We were the first country to impose sanctions on Russia for its political manipulation of an independence referendum in Crimea. And yet, when it comes to Canada, he seems to have taken a page from Putin's playbook. I apologize. Activists such as myself are not supposed to be negative. We're supposed to end on a positive note, a call to action. Well, we live in a nation where 23% of the people can elect a dictator. And no, I don't mean that rhetorically. Harper must sign off on all nomination papers for every MP. That means the MPs do not have a loyalty to the constituency or even to Canada as a whole, but to Emperor Harper. As long as the Conservatives have a majority in Parliament, a majority whose loyalties are not to Canada but to Harper, well, what else can you expect? The Fair Elections Act will be an important test if there's anything left in our voice. The numbers, the prominence, the expertise, the international condemnation of this act. Well, if he passes this bill, it will be time perhaps for extra electoral solutions. I hope to say that I'm wrong. Anyway, we'll return after this short break. So, there is an update to this story about the CBC and its pending budget cuts. It seems that some of the top talent at the CBC are making a principal stand to help get the message out to Canadians what damage is being done to the CBC and the nation as a whole. Three prominent members of the CBC, Lyndon McIntyre, co-host of The Fifth Estate, Alison Smith, host of CBC's radio's flagship news program, The World at Six, and Nancy Wilson are leaving the CBC as a sign of protest, but as well as activism. In a speech, the current head of the CBC, LaCroix, said, "There is an urgent need for a national conversation about the CBC, that if we all believe in a public broadcasting, then we need to support it, adjust its mandate to reflect the complexities of the current media environment, and to give it the resources it needs to fulfill that mandate." I remind my listeners that out of a list of 18 Western nations, our funding per person ranks 16th, one-third the average. We spend only $34 per Canadian, while France spends $79, England $111, and Norway over $160. It's time we made noise and demanded action from our government. As It Happens is having a special call-in show about the future of the CBC. It's broadcasting just after our show at 6:30 on CBC Radio 1. You can contact them by phone at 1-866-418-5716, email aih@cbc.ca, or tweet them at CBC As It Happens. So I'm going to leave this subject with the words of Lyndon McIntyre as he explains why he's leaving the CBC. Let's listen.
To turn now to something close to our hearts, that would be the layoffs here at Canada's public broadcaster. And you may have heard a $130 million budget shortfall forced the CBC to make some very difficult decisions. 657 jobs are being eliminated. And yesterday, one very high-profile member of CBC News announced he is leaving voluntarily. Veteran investigative journalist and co-host of The Fifth Estate for 24 years, Lyndon McIntyre is joining me to talk about his decision. Wow, the stories you've told. And now you've got a different story to tell.
Well, yeah, it's a personal story, and it is very personal. I made a choice. There are 657 of me. Probably most of them people have never heard of. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody knows their work. So I thought, well, maybe one of the 657 should be visible, should be somebody that people recognize, and maybe they can think more about the 657 and perhaps become aware of the fact that an awful lot of the 657 people are young, bright, talented, and they represent the future of the CBC. And we start losing them at this point, we're losing the future. It's a tragedy. And it's a human tragedy. It's also an institutional tragedy. And I suppose it's not pushing it to say it's a national tragedy.
You know, one of the things we always do as journalists is, and you do this as well, you try to put a face to the story, right? People will care if they can put someone's face on mm-hmm. this story, and it humanizes it. So what did you do? You woke up and you thought it should be my face?
Well, I sat around and I listened to Hubert Lacroix, and mm-hmm. I listened to Heather Conway, and I listened to all the bosses talking about the fact that these are cuts that people are going to notice. And then I realized, probably not, because these are people cuts and the people are anonymous to the public. The work is not. Positions will disappear. There's no incentive for the old timers like me to sort of like pack up and go. There's no financial. So an awful lot of people are in a position where they probably are spiritually and physically motivated to retire or move on, but they haven't got this financial security. And there's quite consciously and purposely no financial incentive for anybody to retire or leave at this point, which means that all the cuts and slashing will happen inevitably at the bottom end of the production scale. Young people, even if a middle-aged person's position is cut, that person will have seniority to bump out somebody younger. And I think, you know, it's a nasty process, and it undermines the institution, it undermines morale, but more important, it undermines the future. I got a lot of gifts, I got a lot of work left in me, but I don't have any potential. You know, I'm fully finished. And I think that it's the people with potential that will carry this place forward or not.
And you've learned, and you know, the growth that you've had as a journalist has happened here at CBC, so you must have a lot of very good memories for an institution that has helped you to discover your potential. So what do you do with it?
Well, I don't know. I snap at people who say I'm retiring, because you don't retire from my kind of job. You move on. And I become self-employed, essentially. I will not be working for the CBC. Okay. And it's as simple as that. And I've had 38 years. I became a human being in many ways.
You know, this is a story from the heart. You've told so many stories of heartache on the Fifth Estate, sitting and listening to people telling you their hearts are broken. And here I am with you. And I know this is... this is one of those things from the heart for you.
Don't do that. You know, it's very difficult. It's very difficult.
I want to thank you, Lyndon. I wish you the best. I hope you write, you do whatever it is that you love to do.
Thanks.
I'm not allowed to hug, but I'm going to.
I'm getting it.
Come on.
I'm getting it. Plus you make me look tall.
I've always thought you were fabulous. I've, in fact, often asked Lyndon to run away with me, but his wife wouldn't let him do that.
Yes.
Retiring co-host of CBC's The Fifth Estate, Lyndon McIntyre. Thank you, Lyndon.
Oh, my. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, Bam Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
Hello and welcome back. Okay, shifting gears a little. I was listening to a discussion on the CBC where someone was pushing to make it more difficult to become a Canadian citizen. Discussions like these are happening on the eve of the government introducing a new bill that will reform the Canadian Citizenship Act. The reforms will likely include things like extending the wait time before a landed immigrant can apply for citizenship while speeding up the actual application once they've actually made it. Also, ensuring that they actually live in Canada 4 out of 5 years. Some had argued that if you live outside the country for too many years, your citizenship should be revoked. The logic there is some people get Canadian citizenship as sort of a safety net. If they get sick, they can return to Canada for health care. If they get in legal trouble, they can fall back on Canada as a refugee sort of thing. Of course, the current bill is avoiding one of the major issues, baby tourism. And I must confess, I don't have the numbers to substantiate whether this is really a problem or not, but this is a practice where some pregnant women come to Canada as tourists to give birth to the children so that, in the future, their child could claim Canadian citizenship. This would allow the kids to completely sidestep the whole immigration process. Oh yes, and the law will bestow upon the government the power to revoke citizenship under, quote, extreme circumstances. Jaw drops to the floor. Okay, I'm going to stop here, because this requires an entire segment all on its own. But alas, not today. Now, it happens during this discussion I learned an interesting fact. So pop quiz, who were the first Canadians? Okay, yes, First Nations people. But no, what I mean is, in what year could you find an official, legal, quote, Canadian citizen? Well, you're wrong. Well, you were if you said 1867. Now, some might say it was 1910 when the Immigration Act actually used the word Canadian citizen, but only in reference to people who lived in Canada and not as citizens of the nation of Canada. British subjects were considered de facto citizens, and the main target was actually to prevent undesirable people, i.e. colored and the Jews, from entering Canada freely. Only a little over a decade later was the term Canadian national used in the Canadian National Act. All these terms were sort of subcategories, though, of British subjects. You were first and foremost a citizen of the British Empire, then one of the sub-nations. On your passport, it said British subject. It was not until 1931, in the Statutes of Westminster, that Canada was actually no longer considered a colony of Britain, but an independent nation. Wait, hold on, you might say. Didn't that happen in 1867? No, not really. Our independence was more evolutionary than revolutionary. But even with this apparent graduation into nationhoods, we were still considered British subjects. This all changed with the passage of the Citizenship Act in 1946, which made, as of January 1st, 1947, all people born in Canada naturalized citizens. British citizens who lived in Canada for more than 20 years, spouses of Canadians and their children. At a stroke of midnight, we were magically transformed from boring British subjects to proud Canadian citizens. We were the first colony to be peacefully separated from the empire and the first to define their own sense of citizenship. Take that, Australia! Proud? Damn right I'm proud. But now you might think I am playing the sense of pride too much. But listen to a CBC report on the event in 1947. How we have changed as a people since then. But listen to the subdued pride, the truly Canadian sense of achievement in his voice when you listen to him describe the events that happened January 1st, 1947.
New Year's Day, 1947. Today, for the first time, Canadians officially became Canadians through the Canadian Citizenship Act. Tonight, we've asked Blair Fraser, Ottawa editor of Maclean's magazine, to explain what the new status means to us. He speaks from Ottawa.
You may not have noticed it, but a change came over most of us today. For the first time in any real or full sense of the word, we're Canadian citizens. Up to and including yesterday, when we called ourselves Canadians, it didn't mean very much more than a kind of regional tag like Blue Nose or Sourdough. Showed where you were born. When we got a passport, it didn't call us Canadian. It read British subject by birth. The census taker wouldn't let you put yourself down as plain Canadian. You had to hyphenate it. English Canadian, Ukrainian Canadian, so on. The term Canadian citizen had only one meaning. For the narrow purposes of the Immigration Act, it meant a person entitled to free entry into the country. And then for the new Canadian, the man born abroad who was entering the fellowship of this country with all its rights and responsibilities, we used to swear these people in job lots like a coroner's jury. There was far more solemnity and formality about becoming a Boy Scout than about becoming a Canadian. The Oath of Allegiance didn't even contain the word Canada. Well, all that came to an end today. Today, the new Canadian Citizenship Act came into effect. We're still British subjects, of course, but our passports won't any longer lump us in with all the other British subjects on whom the sun never sets. Those coming into the Canadian nation will do it in future with some dignity and ceremony. The first ceremony taking place here in Ottawa the day after tomorrow. For the people born or already naturalized here, nothing actually happens. We all become Canadian citizens automatically without doing anything. But the men who framed the new act did hope that even for us it would mean something, that in thus defining and clarifying the status of the Canadian, it would give us perhaps a new pride in our country, perhaps a new awareness of the rights we enjoy and the duties that we undertake. This is Blair Fraser speaking from Ottawa.
On that patriotic note, let's end the segment with the most appropriate of songs. Return after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Hello, and we're back. So there's been a bit of a controversy lately over the decision of the McMillan Space Center to allow a Valentine's show entitled Cosmological Love Connection to use their facilities. The blurb from the show goes like this. Hey babe, what's your sign? Join us in the Planetarium Star Theater and celebrate Valentine's Day with a fun, lighthearted, and romantic look at the night sky from both the perspective of an astrologer and an astronomical point of view. Now, on first glance, it could be someone using astrology, something we know in our culture, as a way of informing people about astronomy. Maybe something about how real science allows us to understand where astrology goes wrong. So I thought I would do a little investigation into the presenters of the show. A Rose Marcus of Astrolink, a site that promotes evolutionary astrology, she offers chart reading, she also has tarot cards and clairvoyance, she promotes webinars on these topics on our website. So of course, what is evolutionary astrology, you might ask? She states it as, and I quote, "Evolutionary astrology studies the past life dynamics that have brought an individual to present circumstances and level of personal development. But understanding the past and how far one has come, one can learn how best to facilitate the soul's intended growth for the current life." Now, before I discuss the other co-presenters, some have claimed that a public educational institution should not be allowed to promote such crap as astrology. I'll explain later why it's crap, but for the moment, let's assume. The center rents out its facilities. The Star Theater seats about 230 people. It costs $200 an hour to rent. Tickets about $13.
So about 20 or so people show up, and the rest is profit. I mentioned profit because this is a bit of a commercial exchange. If the center had banned this event, it's likely that it would have been sued. What is more curious is the listed co-host, Dr. Jeremy Matthews. He qualifies as a real astronomer and excellent at presenting science to the public. He's even presented at Skeptic Camp on who needs the paranormal. So I'm wondering how this show will ultimately work out. With him on the show, I do have some minor hope it will be actually an educational event after all. So I asked your indulgence on calling astrology crap. Let me now explain. So to start, what is astrology? The simple explanation is our lives, our fates, are written in the stars. From the moment of our birth to our deaths, understanding where our star sign is can provide guidance as to how to live our lives and what events will lie in our future. Well, not really, but I shall pretend it's true. The likely origin of astrology lays in our first species understanding that patterns in the night sky repeat. In a very simplistic way, we could, quote, predict when the weather would turn cold by the position of the stars. It's likely things like migration patterns of animals or fruiting times of plants were correlated with star movements. It was only a matter of time that people began to think that the secret knowledge of the sky could tell us something about our own personal lives. Voila, a charlatan is born. The first people to organize the sky into the zodiac, as we know them, were the second millennium Babylonians, although there is some speculation that the Sumerians were casting horoscopes 1,000 years earlier. Regardless, the Babylonians definitely were using the stars for divination. The hope was, in a world that mortals had little control over, the stars would help them predict disasters or the right time to attack the neighboring kingdom. When was the best time to have a child to ensure it would be a strong king? It's important to note, this is also a time when, quote, seers used the entails of animals to predict the same kind of future. It was not until the Persians invaded Egypt and then Alexander the Great invaded and finally the Ptolemaic dynasty that the horoscope astrology as we know it was born. And that was in about the 2nd-ish century BCE. By the Middle Ages, astrology was not only used to predict the rise and fall of empires or whether the king should marry that princess or not, but it was also an active part of diagnostic medicine. Yes, before medical treatment was performed, it was the duty of the, quote, doctor to ensure the stars were appropriately aligned to ensure maximal effect. It was during the Enlightenment that astrology metamorphed into astronomy. Some have credited the work of Johannes Kepler, who was a firm believer in astrology and yet proved the perfect spheres of astrology was wrong, and his three laws paved the way for Voyager leaving the solar system. It's one of the darkest embarrassments of modern science that the eminent father of physics, Isaac Newton, wrote far more on alchemy and astrology than on physics. Okay, maybe not as much in astrology, but definitely alchemy. But the point is, at this time, one could be forgiven for thinking astrology was a valid science. It is interesting that, thanks to the wobble of the Earth, that my actual zodiac is not my actual astrological zodiac. Or maybe put a different way, my astrological zodiac does not conform with my astrological zodiac. Astrologically, Capricorns are born between the 25th of December and the 20th of January. But the time that Capricorn rises is actually on the between the 15th of January and the 14th of February. Whew, so technically I am still a Capricorn. But you can see as time goes, the facts of astrology are contradicted by the reality of the universe. I've heard some believers state that the constellations were only placeholders. It's not the stars per se, but that portion of sky, which is constant. So it seems a failure vis-a-vis the actual. Where are the planets and the stars? Re horoscope. But well, can the stars have an influence on us? Let's just assume for the moment. Can the stars actually influence our lives? Well, often it is mentioned that the alignment of the stars have a gravitational effect. And I'm, of course, excluding energy field effects here. Well, okay, let's go into all that. What is an energy field? Honestly, it's nothing. It's like saying, what is a box full of stuff? What is stuff? Nothing. There's no such thing as energy. I hear gasps from the audience. Energy means nothing in and of itself. It's a placeholder, or maybe a placeholder for a measure of something else. Energy can be electricity, gravity, kinetic motion, chemicals. Energy in and of itself simply means a unit of energy that does work. It's a unit of measure. It is not a thing in itself. That is, it's a measure of something else. There is no thing called energy. But there's lots of stuff that can do work we call energy. Think sugar, think battery, think gasoline. So when an astrologer says that the planets have influence, have energies that can influence ourselves, what do they mean? Well, they could mean light from the stars. But that would mean that any child born indoors would not be affected. It could mean gravity. Jupiter is big and has lots of gravity. But the laws of physics states that although less massive, but much, much closer, your pediatrician has much more gravitational influence on you than Jupiter does. So we're left with some sort of imaginary force. And well, that's actually okay. There have been times in the history of progress where we've known that there's a force, but not actually known what that force is. In the past, magnetism. Currently, think dark matter or dark energy. These are real effects with unknown causes. We could say that the effects of astrology are real even if we have no idea about how it works. Okay. But there is a catch to that. We know that dark matter exists because it has a consistent, measurable effect on the universe. Consistent. There have been many studies to show that the effects of the mysterious dark matter, it matters. Yet every experiment into astrology has shown nothing more than random chance. This is where the astrologist must either put up or shut up. They make claims for a force, which they cannot prove actually exists, that influences the worlds in a way that they cannot actually prove is actually being influenced. So it seems to me the case is closed. Astrology is bunk. But I would like to put an epilogue onto this. I actually kind of like horoscopes in some ways, in the same way I used to use cold reading with tarot cards in high school. It was a psychological method of introspection or talk therapy. I do not think this justifies the millions of dollars that are wasted in this industry, but even the most blatant woo sometimes can have some redeeming qualities. Okay, now some of you may think, hey Don, that was a pretty quick and light treatment of astrology. And yeah, that's kind of true. So I'm going to end the show with a clip from Carl Sagan's Cosmos series, where he basically does the whole debunking of astrology and does it much better than I could have. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
There are two ways to view the stars, as they really are and as we might wish them to be. These are the Pleiades, a group of young stars astronomers recognize as leaving their stellar nurseries of gas and dust. And this is the Crab Nebula, a stellar graveyard where gas and dust are being dispersed back into the interstellar medium. Inside it is a dying pulsar. Both the Pleiades and the Crab Nebula are in a constellation that astrologers long ago named Taurus the Bull. They imagined it to influence our daily lives. Astronomers say that the planet Saturn is an immense globe of hydrogen and helium, encircled by a ring of snowballs 50,000 kilometers wide, and that Jupiter's great red spot is a giant storm raging for perhaps a million years. But the astrologers see the planets as affecting human character and fate. Jupiter represents a regal bearing and a gentle disposition, and Saturn, the gravedigger, fosters, they say, mistrust, suspicion, and evil. To the astronomers, Mars is a place as real as the Earth, a world awaiting exploration. But the astrologers see Mars as a warrior, the instigator of quarrels, violence, and destruction. Astronomy and astrology were not always so distinct. For most of human history, the one encompassed the other. But there came a time when astronomy escaped from the confines of astrology. The two traditions began to diverge in the life and mind of Johannes Kepler. It was he who demystified the heavens by discovering that a physical force lay behind the motions of the planets. He was the first astrophysicist and the last scientific astrologer. The intellectual foundations of astrology were swept away 300 years ago, and yet astrology is still taken seriously by a great many people. Have you ever noticed how easy it is to find a magazine on astrology? Virtually every newspaper in America has a daily column on astrology. Almost none of them have even a weekly column on astronomy. People wear astrological pendants, check their horoscopes before leaving the house. Even our language preserves an astrological consciousness. For example, take the word disaster. It comes from the Greek for bad star. The Italians once believed that disease was caused by the influence of the stars. It's the origin of our word influenza. The zodiacal signs used by astrologers even ornament this statue of Prometheus in New York City. Prometheus, who stole fire from the gods. What is all this astrology business? Fundamentally, it's the contention that which constellations the planets are in at the moment of your birth profoundly influences your future. A few thousand years ago, the idea developed that the motions of the planets determine the fates of kings, dynasties, empires. Astrologers studied the motions of the planets and asked themselves what had happened last time that, say, Venus was rising in the constellation of the goat. Maybe something similar would happen this time as well. It was a subtle and risky business. Astrologers became employed only by the state. In many countries, it became a capital offense for anyone but the official astrologer to read the portents in the skies. Why? Because a good way to overthrow a regime was to predict its downfall. Chinese court astrologers who made inaccurate predictions were executed. Others simply doctored the records so that afterwards they were in perfect conformity with events. Astrology developed into a strange discipline, a mixture of careful observations, mathematics, and record keeping with fuzzy thinking and pious fraud. Nevertheless, astrology survived and flourished. Why? Because it seems to lend a cosmic significance to the routine of our daily lives. It pretends to satisfy our longing to feel personally connected with the universe. Astrology suggests a dangerous fatalism. If our lives are controlled by a set of traffic signals in the sky, why try to change anything? Here, look at this. Here's two different newspapers published in the same city on the same day. Let's see what they do about astrology. Suppose you were a Libra that is born between September 23rd and October 22nd. According to the astrologer for the New York Post, compromise will help ease tension. Well, maybe. It's sort of vague. According to the New York Daily News' astrologer, demand more of yourself. Well, also vague, but also pretty different. It's interesting that these predictions are not predictions. They tell you what to do. They don't say what's going to happen. They're consciously designed to be so vague that it could apply to anybody, and they disagree with each other. Astrology can be tested by the lives of twins. There are many real cases like this. One twin is killed in childhood in, say, a riding accident or is struck by lightning, but the other lives to a prosperous old age. Suppose that happened to me. My twin and I would be born in precisely the same place and within minutes of each other. Exactly the same planets would be rising at our births. If astrology were valid, how could we have such profoundly different fates? It turns out that astrologers can't even agree among themselves what a given horoscope means. In careful tests, they're unable to predict the character and future of people they know nothing else about except the time and place of birth. Also, how could it possibly work? How could the rising of Mars at the moment of my birth affect me then
or now. I was born in a closed room. Light from Mars couldn't get in. The only influence of Mars which could affect me was its gravity. But the gravitational influence of the obstetrician was much larger than the gravitational influence of Mars. Mars is a lot more massive, but the obstetrician was a lot closer.
The desire to be connected with the cosmos reflects a profound reality. For we are connected, not in the trivial ways that the pseudoscience of astrology promises, but in the deepest ways. Our little planet is under the influence of a star. The sun warms us, it drives the weather, it sustains all living things. 4 billion years ago, it brought forth life on Earth. But our sun is only one of a billion trillion stars within the observable universe. And those countless suns all obey natural laws, some of which are already known to us. How did we discover that there are such laws?
If we lived on a planet where nothing ever changed, there wouldn't be much to do. There'd be nothing to figure out. There'd be no impetus for science. And if we lived in an unpredictable world, where things changed in random or very complex ways, we wouldn't be able to figure things out. And again, there'd be no such thing as science. But we live in an in-between universe, where things change all right, but according to patterns, rules, or as we call them, laws of nature. If I throw a stick up in the air, it always falls down. If the sun sets in the west, it always rises again the next morning in the east. And so it's possible to figure things out. We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives. Human beings are good at understanding the world. We always have been. We were able to hunt game or build fires only because we had figured something out. There once was a time, before television, before motion pictures, before radio, before books. The greatest part of human existence was spent in such a time. And then, over the dying embers of the campfire, on a moonless night, we watched the stars. The night sky is interesting. There are patterns there. If you look closely, you can see pictures.
One of the easiest constellations to recognize lies in the northern skies. In North America, it's called the Big Dipper. The French have a similar idea. They call it la casserole, the casserole. In medieval England, this same pattern of stars reminded people of a simple wooden plow. The ancient Chinese had a more sophisticated notion. To them, these stars carried the celestial bureaucrat on his rounds about the pole of the sky, seated on the clouds and accompanied by his eternally hopeful petitioners. The people of Northern Europe imagined yet another pattern. To them, it was Charles's wain, or wagon, a medieval cart. But other cultures saw these seven stars as part of a larger picture. It was the tail of a great bear, which the ancient Greeks and Native Americans saw instead of the handle of a dipper. but surely the most imaginative interpretation of this larger group of stars was that of the ancient Egyptians. They made out a curious procession of a bull and a reclining man, followed by a strolling hippopotamus with a crocodile on its back. What a marvelous diversity in the images various cultures saw in this particular constellation. But the same is true for all the other constellations.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
Thank you all for joining me as we rewind some of the best of the 240s. Tune in next week for an all-new show. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate. We think too much and feel too little. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness. Without these qualities, life will be violent. And all will be lost. Do not despair. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die. Dictators die. And the power they took from the people will return to the people. Will return to the people. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, to do away with greed. Now let us fight to free the world, to fulfill that promise. Let us all unite. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Despise you, enslave you.